Okay, you can actually hear me, right? Okay. Good evening, everyone. I didn't think there'd be more than a handful in this glorious weather, but thank you for coming. The idea in these four sessions is to introduce the core Buddhist concepts. So a lot of people have been coming here for some time and they say we don't know what the three refuges are when it's mentioned, or the four noble truths, which are core concepts. So I'm dealing with these concepts at a very much a nutshell kind of a level, but hopefully it's enough to then for you to chase up further about that. So the four topics over the 4 weeks. First one is the three refuges. Then next week, we'll deal with the five precepts. The week after, the four noble truths, which is, of course, the heart of the Buddha's teaching. And it's a bit presumptuous, really, for somebody to say they're going to cover it in, you know, 45 minutes or something. But anyway, a mud map. Then the eightfold path, which is the final session, which is the actual elaboration of the practice. So during this session, I'll start off with the notes and introduce it, but then you can ask questions relating to this or other topics in the Dhamma that you've come across. I've got one of my senior colleagues here, Priya, to help me out if you ask, you know, curly questions. But there's some paper there left to write any questions. If you, when you think about them, just jot them down and pass it on. Okay. So the three refuges. Some of you probably already know what these are, but essentially, to define them, the three refuges, which we also describe as the triple gem. In other words, these are very precious. So the first of the triple gems is the Buddha, the teacher, who has given us this teaching. The second of the triple gems is the Dhamma. It's the teaching that he expounded. And the third is the Sangha. That is not just, people think that the Sangha means monks and nuns. It's not. It is those who have practiced and have entered one of the stages of enlightenment. So you can be in robes, you can be in jeans, it doesn't matter, right? But the point is, these are the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha are the three refuges. Now, what tends to happen, and this happened going back 2,500 years ago, when people began to understand the Buddha's teachings, and became interested in adopting them as their guiding principle, there was a tradition which we call going for refuge. So you find this even in the early teachings. People, after the end of the teachings, they say to the Buddha, we would like to go for refuge. So this has now become like a formality. So you will find that even in our Buddhist society, people join in and they want to become, first of all, members as associate members. But then after a while, they feel, you know, they want to make a deeper commitment and they say they want to become full members. At that point, we ask that they go for refuge and take the five precepts, usually from Ajahn Brahm or one of the other monks. And so it's a sort of a formalization of their commitment. If they wish to. So the five precepts, as I said, we'll discuss in the next session. Now, the attitude of going for refuge is important in that it's your foundation as you practice, and it's a refuge, you know, it's what you go to. When things are shaky, you remind yourself of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It gives you this grounding, this shelter. So the question is, what do we need refuge from? Well, what we need refuge from is dukkha, the suffering that we are inevitably confronted in this life. And of course, if you have a Buddhist perspective, you would say that it is also what we confront in the repeating rounds of birth and death, samsara. So the Buddha has said, according to the teachings that have come down, that just to illustrate the amount of suffering we go through, that the tears that we have wept in the cycle of, in our journey through samsara to now, those tears are more than the waters in the four great oceans. So you can imagine how many times we have experienced and grieved and suffered. But fortunately, we don't remember those things. Maybe not so fortunately, but so in our journey to free ourselves from this suffering, we need a refuge. And the refuge is the Buddha, because he, by his own efforts, reached liberation or Nibbana or Nirvana. And he clearly described a path, which is the Dhamma. So the Dhamma is the teaching which is well described and can be followed and leads to liberation. And the Sangha, as I said, are those who have already walked that path and have reached some stages of liberation. And even in the world today, we believe there are people who are on that path, on a stage of enlightenment. So, so it is, as we go through this journey, which is actually quite more treacherous than we imagine, actually. It's only when we really fall off a cliff that we realize, oh my goodness, this is happening to me, this is happening, I've got cancer, I'm going to die. Suddenly your world falls apart. Well, the Buddha said, look, this is how it is. But then in order to be able to accept that and work with that, there is a path that he has prescribed, which we can follow if we wish to. So this is why refuge is needed. And as your practice becomes deeper, your confidence in the refuges becomes deeper. I come from a Buddhist background in Sri Lanka, where, you know, we were taught to take the refuges when we were toddlers, you know. So we were saying it without really appreciating the significance of it. And only later in life, now when things fall apart, yes, there is a refuge. Yes, 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 you remind yourself of the Dhamma and you kind of find your way back. And yes, this is what I work with, this is what I practice with in order to understand and see the reality of all this, which is, of course, the path to liberation. So as you become more confident in the practice, the refuges become internalized and it gives you great confidence. There are many people who actually take the refuges on a daily basis. Just get out of bed in the morning and you go through your refuges and your five precepts, kind of set your compass. So many people do that. Sometimes there's a notion that maybe going to the refuges, the Buddha is going to do something for you. No, it's not. You know, the Buddha has attained Nibbana, he's no longer in samsara, but he has left behind a teaching. So it's recollecting the qualities of the Buddha, recollecting the qualities of the Dhamma, recollecting the qualities of the Sangha, you kind of get your bearings. But, you know, he himself is not going to kind of, you know, save you or something. So the tradition of this act of going for refuge is a ceremony, and it's still chanted today in Pali language, which is the language of the Buddha. And, you know, it goes back 2,500 years, and I think we still find it moving when I listen to someone taking the refuges and the precepts. Often at Vesak, Ajahn Brahm would lead people who want to make this commitment, he'd go through the refuges and the precepts, and you know, it's quite moving for those. Now, I have given the ceremony here. Yeah, I'll scroll down a bit later. If you want to, I can recite it just so that you know how it sounds in the Pali and what it means. But it doesn't mean that you're going to take refugees or five precepts. It's just, and quite often in some of our ceremonies you'll hear this. So we always start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Usually you hear it said three times. So homage to him, the blessed one, the noble one, the perfectly enlightened one, samma sambuddhassa. Then we go for refuge. Buddhang saranang gacchami. To the Buddha, I go for refuge. So the order is Buddham, to the Buddha, saranam is refuge, gacchami is I go to. Dhammang, same thing, to the Dhamma, I go for refuge. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sangang saranang gacchami. Then you find we say the whole thing just for a second time. Dutiyampi. Buddhan saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi. Second time. Dhamman saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi. Sangang saranang gacchami. Then for the third time. Tatiyampi. Buddhan saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi. Dhamman saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi. Sangang saranang gacchami. I won't go to the precepts now, but this is the start of that ceremony. It's quite simple, and you know, over time you sort of, yeah, I've heard that. You know, the familiarity comes, but that's what it means. Often when you come here, you will see people bowing to the statue, Buddha statue, and often they bow three times. So in a sense, it is the Buddhan saranang gacchami, second one the Dhamman saranang gacchami, third one the Sangang saranang gacchami. So if you see that, that's one of the meanings of the bowing. So maybe I've said enough for the moment about the three refuges. What would you like to know? Are there any questions, comments?
Can you hear me? I used to think that when people were bowing to the statue, they were bowing to a statue, but that's not what it's about, is it?
No, it is on the one, at one level, it is paying your respects to a great teacher.
Yeah.
But there's no sense of this statue going to do anything for you.
Yeah.
But it is an object of reflection and meditation. Mm. So a lot of the things, even the bowing, you'll find that in the Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, they bow, the bowing itself is done as a meditation.
Right. Okay.
So it is always with that kind of reflective mindset that you go for refuge, right, or you bow to the Buddha.
Yeah. Yes. Because coming from a Christian but non-Catholic background, I find statues, you know, it doesn't really, I mean, the Buddha one does now, but yeah, initially I found that quite difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, we don't expect that people should bow to the Buddha statue when they come here. It is purely if it is driven by from within that you want to bow, you want to pay respects in this way. Some people will pay their respects very quietly internally, you know, just a quiet sitting meditation, that's all.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of the bowing, is that at the beginning of a session and at the end?
Both, yes. Most of the time you'll find people just walk in and they bow and they sit quietly. And then when the monks come in, they'll do it again, you know. And at the end, we always end with the bowing, yes. Yep.
And with taking the refuges, is it required in the Pali language or
no?
You can do it in English as well?
You can, yes. In fact, in the ceremonies here, we sometimes just do it in English, just give the translation so that we don't, you know, people... the whole idea in the Buddhist teachings, you have to know what you're doing, you have to understand what you're doing.
Right.
So, obviously, Pali is not our language, so...
Yeah.
But it is a beautiful way of remembering. It's quite concise, and if you know the verse, it just sort of... And you understand what you're saying, it flows, and, you know...
I find that when I, after the day's travails, when you go up at night and kneel in front of the statue, everything just falls away. As it just about three times.
You can use the practice to suit your where you're at and how it does help some people to gather themselves and just settle the mind. Good. Other people, if you find, oh my goodness, here's another statue, don't get kind of... But, you know, many years ago, the very first meditation retreat I went to and was taken by a monk and, you know, everybody's bowing. I said, look, I don't want to bow. He said, look, it's okay, you don't have to bow. This is your practice, you know, this is what it means, but you don't have to do this, so... Yes.
Hello. I just wondered when one can call oneself a Buddhist. Is it? I thought it was just the nuns and the monks that were actually Buddhists.
No. It's an interesting question because, you know. In a sense, when you take the refuges and the precepts, then you call yourself a Buddhist. That's the formal definition. But, you know, I think it depends on your practice. And there are people who I've come across who are very Buddhist, but they have never called themselves Buddhist. They won't, you know, it doesn't, that it's a label that doesn't enter their minds. But the practice is... That is what's in the teachings. So
it's your choice.
Yes.
Mm. Mm. Okay, thank you. I've had about four questions answered so far that I've had. Thanks.
I was just going to say, what's another word for refuge? That's the word I was thinking of.
Shelter.
Shelter.
Yes.
I take shelter.
Shelter.
Yeah. Okay.
Shelter from, Both. I think it's a shelter that helps you to then deal with all the travails that you're facing, But that is your little shelter, which is very powerful when it's used,
come into your mind very quickly. You know, it speeds up the process rather than you might go around all your problems. Oh, this is why that happened. That is why that happened. All that just drops away. And in many ways, it speeds up your settling down to meditation. When you think of the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, you get into that frame of mind quicker. So.
So you mentioned, you know, some people wake up in the morning and you know, go through a process of acknowledging the triple gem or the precepts. And I just wondered if there were any mantras that people use.
I think we don't refer to them often as mantras, but we do talk about chanting.
Chanting.
Right. So many people would start the day by chanting Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa, and the whole thing. So many people use that as their sort of pre-meditation meditation, the chanting.
Yes.
Then some people also use the Metta Sutta, which is the discourse on loving kindness, because that helps to settle all your kind of the more negative, angry, enmity, those sorts of the feelings. So they will chant this, followed by chanting the Metta Sutta. So people have their own little routine of getting the mind into meditative states.
It's a nice way to start the day.
Yes, and end the day. Yes.
What is our relationship with the monks and the nuns interacting?
At one level, there is quite a formal way of interacting. So because monks and nuns are in robes and they have taken a number of precepts that they have to abide by, called the Vinaya. Monks have 240 rules. I mean, we lay people follow 5 precepts. They have 227, I think, for monks and 300 and something for nuns. Oh. We won't go into that. But so they can't do certain things that we normally do. You come, you shake hands with people. They have no physical contact with others. So there are lots of rules that they have to adhere to, which makes our relationship with the nuns and monks have a certain formal distance in order to respect that, because that is their chosen practice, which helps them in developing their path. There are many, the common interactions take place over dana, because monks and nuns rely on lay people to provide the basic requisites: shelter, food, medicine, and there are 4 requisites. So you will see the meal dana, the people offering food every Sunday morning. It happens here when the monks are not in Raids Retreat, which they are now. But when they finish the Raids Retreat, they'll be back. Otherwise, we'll go to the monastery and offer food. And you will see there's a formal process, how we put the food into the bowl. And, they will have in their mind, may this assist your path to Nibbana, or, there's a blessing that they don't necessarily say. But so it's a bit distant relationship in that sense. But it doesn't stop you from, if you have personal problems or you want to talk to someone, a monk won't see you as a woman, they will not speak to you by themselves. There will always be another monk, or there will be another woman, so that, there's no question of any improper closeness or in the speech or in behavior. Similarly with nuns, you can have personal conversations, discuss personal problems, but they will also really have someone there if it is the same, if it's the opposite sex.
So they're spiritual guides?
Yes. So their role is to practice, develop their own understanding of the Buddha's teaching, and then teach it to us, teach it to those who wish to be taught. So this is the kind of quid pro quo thing between the lay people and the Sangha. They have intensive practice from which they will develop their own knowledge of the teachings and therefore be able to teach. We, the lay people, support them to do that job. They will give us back the results of that job, their efforts.
I'm not sure if it's a good question, but if according to samsara, we forget our previous lives. And what if you don't have time over your one lifetime to reach level enough to remember it? Doesn't that mean that you're eternally doomed, kind of, because you can't remember your lives, and it'll be just a repeating thing where you try to reach, even if you try to reach the Buddhism height, you can't reach it, and you just keep...
No, because most of us have forgotten what happened in our previous lives, although there are some people, especially when they're young, who recall their past lives, and they have been verified and so on. But for most of us, it's not conscious, right? But the way we come out of this round of samsara is by making an effort in this life. Maybe it doesn't finish in this life. For most of us, there'll be more and more lives where the path still is going on, right? But in each life, one hopes that you will be able to tread the Eightfold Path, which is the path for liberating yourself from this repeating cycle.
But to liberate yourself, you need to reach some height. And if you keep forgetting it, doesn't that mean, like, if you can't reach it over one lifetime?
No. Because that's the whole principle of karma. So what karma you develop in this life will be, it's not that there's you carrying your sort of list of good karma into the next life. It is that karma that you have developed in this life will affect your continuity, the mind states that arise in the next life, and indeed the circumstances you'll find yourself in this life or the next.
Okay.
So... just because you don't remember your past life, you actually, the path that you have trodden thus far is still with you, which is partly why you're here today. I mean, that's, people come here and they say, oh, we're drawn to this place, they're drawn to this teaching. And some of them have never heard of Buddhism before. It's as if what we have cultivated in a previous life is giving some fruit in this life, but you know, for most of us,
okay,
the fruits will continue to come.
Thank you.
In the time of the Buddha, large numbers of people attained enlightenment, listening to him, etc. And it wasn't always the most highly educated intellectual people. People who had been just, you know, plowing a field or something, very little formal education, they attained enlightenment, and that's because of their previous practice. So,
I'll try and word this question correctly. I think I'm right in saying you don't actively convert people. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's right.
That is correct.
So,
and in fact, when the Buddha was asked to teach, you had to ask him three times before he would teach you.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, you actually do want to know.
Yeah.
It's not you're being forced or converted. Yeah.
So before one would take the precepts, you would have to be sure you knew what you were doing. You wouldn't just do it on a whim, for example. You know, you have to really be genuine about it. So how do you, because you don't have classes or things like that, do you? So you would just come here on a Friday and listen to the talks and do the meditation and things? Is that how you...
So those would be general aspects, different aspects of the Dhamma will come out in these talks.
Right.
The five precepts themselves, committing to that, it's a very personal thing. And you start with, in whatever way you can. It's not that this is an all or nothing. Some people will start with, you know, the first precept, you know, where you don't harm other living beings.
Yeah.
You might not give up eating meat to begin with. And you may never in this life give up eating meat. But you will not set out to kill. You know, so you... The precepts are, it's a spectrum and it's a case of where you want to, how far you want to take it. but we can talk about that next week. And I think Carl is waiting me to wrap up. No? Okay. Okay.
All right.
So the question I've got is around the etiquette of nourishing the monks and going like down to Serpentine and seeing them during the week early in the morning. What is the actual etiquette there? Because I went a couple of weeks ago and I just felt like a fish out of water, sat in the background and went, well, I better not get too involved. Right. What's the more formal process?
Here, I think it's quite... Ajahn Brahm has set a very relaxed scene for people to feel at ease. But what you did is what a lot of people do. You sit sort of to the back and you watch what's going on and work out how they interact with the monks. But for men interacting with monks, it's not really an issue. You can go up to them and ask Ajahns, whichever Ajahn, when can you speak with them? It's usually after the meal. We can have a chat. People will bow to them, but if it's not your practice or your tradition or you're not ready for that, you don't have to do any of that. You just go and say, hi, Ajahn, I'd like to have a chat, you know? So it's just that there will be no shaking of hands and, hugging or anything like that, but otherwise it's an ordinary conversation. People will bring food to offer. There is a way to offer food and requisites. You place, for men, you can place whatever it is that you have brought, maybe some orange juice or whatever you want to leave in the temple. You offer it and the monk will accept. Ladies, when we offer to the monks, the monk will put a piece of cloth, you put your offering on the piece of cloth, so again it avoids any kind of physical contact, and they'll take it and you bow and it's accepted.
Yeah. Thank you.
I have a second question. It's also about karma. Escaping it, is it like, if we imagine it as a room where we're locked, and is there only one door we can exit using Buddhism, or is there multiple of them and you can use some other way to exit?
I'll start the reply, but I'll put it on to you, Priya, okay? It's not that there's just one door, because it doesn't mean you have to be Buddhist to get out of samsara. What it does mean is that you cultivate certain mind states that will overcome three core operating principles which keep us bound to samsara. Those three are greed, hatred, delusion. It doesn't matter which religion you come from, if you have dealt with greed, hatred, and delusion, that is your path to liberation, right? But I don't know of any other teaching which addresses that directly, how to overcome those three. It's not the way, it's the actual what you cultivate. You can call it what you like. Long as it's non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, then you understand impermanence, suffering, and non-self. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Long as you understand those three, when you fully understand them, that is nibbana. That is liberation. So how you get there is your business. Do you want to add something, Priya?
It's all about purifying your mind. So little by little, it's a change in your worldview. What the Buddha said was, see things as they are, not as they are presented to you on television or anywhere else or by other people. You know, you can, we all disguise ourselves a lot these days, makeup and everything, but see the person within, and also with everything that's happening, see the reality of it. And little by little, you find that basically things that you want become less and less. And the non-self thing, it comes from this concept in Buddhism that it's not that there isn't a self, there isn't a permanent self. So that's where impermanence again comes into it. You can see everything changes. Buddha was the first person. This is why all the scientists, so many of them have praised him, because what they are now discovering in labs and everything else, he said that we are made up of these tiny atoms, the whole body and everything around you.
that it changes every second. But just looking at yourself, first you were a baby, then you were a young person, then you're an old person, and then you're gone. But that doesn't mean that you're gone, you know. So you do go into another birth, but it's not a permanent soul as such. So that's why you take all your karma and everything with you. And that's what the Buddha said, to realize that nothing is permanent, not to let it affect you so much. This too shall pass. Most things are in your mind anyway, and that's where meditation comes into it. When you sit down and meditate, your day's problems seem to be less, you know. It's all wrong at the moment. I'm fine, you know, I'm sitting here perfectly okay. So that's what it's all about, training your mind and, you know, not be deluded by the world around you.
Non-self is a radical concept, so it's a mind-blowing radical concept to be seen. Not unfortunate, I haven't seen it yet. So,
we do talk about people know who are alive, it's certainly how the world has changed.
So we all come from different backgrounds, obviously, and different religions and stuff. So I'm not, I probably know what I'm getting at, but I'm not a super practicing Catholic, even though I was brought up in the Catholic tradition. But I guess if you start practicing Buddhism, can the two continue side by side type thing, you know, or I don't know, do you know, is there any issue with that, or
do people consider themselves as Christians and Buddhists, or is it more, I mean, or am I getting hung up on labels and, you know, if you take the path, and become and practice it.
I think that's the answer, really.
Have I answered
what
myself?
What is the path rather than the label? Yep. But we use labels. Labels can be handy, and it's not a problem for practicing Buddhists to have a few labels in their thinking, in their, you know, because to question is not unusual in the Buddhist teachings. The Buddha said, question things, find out for yourself. So in this process, you can dip into all sorts of paths and find out what makes sense and to understand the real state of affairs is what the Buddha is saying is the path to liberation. So I think in some religions there's a real, you can't go into another church or another teaching. There isn't something like that. You know, you explore, you find out, you work it out for yourself.
Right. Okay. Sounds good.
I think in the Buddhist history, if you like, which dates back 2,500 years, 600 now. There's so much material, you know. There are many, many monks, etc., giving talks. You can get YouTube. You can get so much, you know, Wikipedia. And it's up to you at each stage when you have a question. You don't actually have to go if you don't immediately have a mentor around. You can research it yourself and then think about it and say, yeah, that sounds right to me. So that's the thing in that's another word for the Dhamma that the Buddha said was, this is the truth, you know. And I didn't discover it, I didn't invent it, it's there. And were you aware that he wasn't the only Buddha? You know, no? There have been Buddhas before and there will be Buddhas later. So in Buddhism, they say there are three kinds of enlightened people. There's you and me. We have a teacher. We follow the teacher and, you know, hopefully become enlightened. But there were other beings like this who found it for themselves, and they are called the Samma Sambuddha. But the difference but then there's another kind of Buddha who also found it out for themselves, but they were not interested in teaching others. So there will be a time when Buddhism might not be available, you know, when the world changes. But there will be people who will still find out the truth for themselves. So this Buddha, the reason he's venerated so much is that he was a great teacher. Not only did he discover it, he was able to teach it so that anybody can understand and follow and become enlightened. So
that will be the last question before we...
That's connected to the previous question. So, and you told that a lot of people, we think that become enlightened by being close to Buddha himself. And a lot of people, they're looking for that, finding this enlightened teacher. How important this personal transfer of knowledge is comparing to looking at the YouTube video or reading it or just trying to understand it. How important it is to find the person and sort of actually exploit him to become enlightened himself.
Okay. Some traditions emphasize this, you know, your personal teacher, the relationship with the guru, as being very important for the transmission of the Dhamma. There's a lot of different ideas about that. Certainly, it does help if you have a good teacher when you go deeper into meditative practices, because sometimes you encounter things that you just don't know what to make of. And to be guided through those times and not misread those experiences. So there are times when a good teacher and access to one is very helpful. But there's a lot we can do to develop the path, even if there isn't the one teacher that you're kind of attached to. In the Tibetan tradition, the transmission is very important. But I was in a Tibetan Buddhist meditation retreat, and at the end I said to this teacher, to the Rinpoche, look, I live in Perth. We don't have that much access to teachers. You know, how do you manage in that case? And then he said to me, if your teacher is not in there, you are in trouble. So you have to cultivate that teacher. Carl, I think there are people waiting for the next... the meditation sitting. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for your questions and your interest.